Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. For the last 20 years, George Saunders has been teaching a class on the Russian short story to his MFA students at Syracuse University. In A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, he shares a version of that class with us, offering some of what he and his students have discovered together over the years, paired with iconic short stories by Chekhov, Tolstoy, Gogol, and Turgenev. The seven essays in this book are intended for anyone interested in how fiction works and why it's more relevant than ever in these turbulent times. Saunders is the Booker Prize-winning author of Lincoln and the Bardo and 10th of December, a finalist for the National Book Award. He is a dear friend of this program, and it's a great pleasure to welcome George Saunders to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Thank you for having me, Joe. Always love being here.
I always love having you on the program, partially because you talk so beautifully about your work and about writing, which is essentially what you're doing in this book. You write that the aim of the book is mainly diagnostic. If a story drew us in, kept us reading, made us feel respected, how did it do that? It also seems like a prompt, though, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I the book came out of the class I've taught for 20 years at Syracuse. And I, apart from the subject matter, that teaching has been such a beautiful thing in my life, just because it keeps reminding me that, you know, that people can connect. So there's me, you know, an old dude in a room full of brilliant young writers. And within a few minutes of concentrating on these stories, we're kind of like one unit, you know, that our minds are working together. And that, you know, even maybe that would be true even if you're teaching algebra or teaching physics or something. But just to kind of say, yeah, you know, we, for all of the external troubles in the world, we're actually pretty good at connecting with another person, and we like it and we crave it. So I think I was, in the end, I was kind of using these stories as an excuse to talk really about that, about how do we connect with other people, both the reader and in this case with me, the interpreter of these stories, but also maybe about the way an individual mind works in response to any phenomenon. You know, there's something happens, you react to it, and then as you become, I guess, a mature individual, your reaction, you bless your reaction, you accept it, and then you try to articulate it. So in a sense, it was kind of a scale model of what I would imagine we're doing in any moment of our lives, you know, enduring a phenomenon, reacting, and then moving on, hopefully in a slightly better state.
I was interested in what the pitch meeting was like, where you say, okay, publisher, okay, Random House, I got this cool idea. We're going to do a book on a masterclass on Russian writers. And their response is, okay, George.
Well, it was because, you know, my editor there, Andy Ward, is such a great friend of me. And what he does as an editor is he sort of, it literally encourages you. He gives you courage. You know, I think if I had a different editor, and I'd have pitched it, he'd have gone, yeah, well, yeah, you know, I'm wimpy enough that I might have just walked away from it. But Andy instantly said, all right, if you want to do it, you should do it. I think he understands that, you know, at a certain level in your trajectory, you have an impulse to do something. And if you try it, it's a necessary thing. You have to try this thing in order to get to your next place. But he was totally encouraging about it. He said, yeah, I get that. Go for it. And so that's a great blessing for a writer.
I kept on wondering what it was like for you to write something that you obviously were so comfortable with, in the sense that you've taught this course for so long. You've had so much interaction and discussion about the subject with your students. Is that a different vibe when you start to write about something, knowing that you've really explored it from so many different angles over the years?
Yeah, that's a very perceptive question, Joe. That's exactly what the issue was. I had taught it for so long. And of course, my first optimistic thought was, oh, I'll just type this up. You know, I've got all these class notes. And then two things happen. One is you find out that all those years you haven't been pronouncing an essay. You've been kind of leading these really brilliant horses to the water, and then they take it from there. So there's a whole idea of suggesting a meaning. But then when you're writing it, you've really got to commit and bring it home. And that's, for me, always hours of work. But then the second really happy thing was that I found out, well, it might not be that happy. I found out I'd been under teaching these stories all those years. And when I got into them, they had so much more to say, and they were actually so much better than I even imagined. So that was a cool kind of side benefit was, you know, I went in for a lot of complicated reasons, but when the book was done, I just was in love with the story form all over again, kind of like I was when I was 20. And I also think it's funny, I taught this last semester and my teaching was better. I wasn't teaching this material, but somehow the forcing myself to think rigorously about it kind of clarified my thinking on how to read a student's story, which is unexpected.
I mean, one of the things that's worth noting, I think, is your students in your class, the very few who get to have George Saunders as their professor, it is a slim number, and they, I assume, are quite brilliant, right? I mean, they're really smart kids. They're amazing. You dedicate the book to them, to your students, and which is a beautiful definition, and past, present, and future. So they obviously have great meaning to you, but you're working with the top here, aren't you?
Oh yeah, we get these days we're getting 600 to 700 applications every year, and we're picking six of those to come. So not only are they great writers, but most of them have lived pretty interesting lives, and so they're, we're not, you know, teaching them to write. We're just kind of, as I say in the book, we're trying to, you know, in any way we can, get them to do whatever it is that only they can do. And so that's, it's pretty high altitude work. But boy, is it fun. You know, first you try to do no harm, but then, they're kind of like, I suppose it's a little bit like if you were a basketball coach and Michael Jordan showed up in your class, you know, just throw him the ball and, you know,
Well, that's interesting, because I was thinking about this as I was reading the book, that the one thing missing from this, from your course, is obviously the interactive element of the personal, of dealing with the students. But that is replaced ultimately by you, right? That you become the student in this exploration.
Yes, and what you're exactly right. The big, you know, people have been saying, "Oh, you don't have to get an MFA; just read the book." The big thing in an MFA program is that moment when the student has given me a story. I've spent a long time editing it. We talk about it in the workshop, and then we get that hour-long phone call between or personal meeting between us. That's the really kind of specific, nuanced work that really does some good. Where you know the person, you might know something about her obstructions and her habits. And then you can lightly, it's almost like if somebody was running along and they got caught on a branch in the woods, you know, you might just be able to lightly pick them up off the branch and let them go. So that's my favorite part because, you know, writing, like anything worth doing, generalization has its limits. And a book like this has to be somewhat general. I try to make it more specific by always commenting on specific places in the Russian story. But if I was going to, you know, give a young writer my best, it's the line edits and it's the moments we spend together. Mostly I'm just asking her, you know, how did that edit work for you? What do you think about this? And so that's deep work. And as you say, that's work that is enabled by how good they are. They've already answered all the easy questions for themselves. And now they're up into that, you know, the last 50 feet before the peak of the mountain or whatever.
You're ultimately helping them find where their power lies, right? As a writer.
Exactly right. And yes, exactly. I always say that, you know, one of the kind of indicators that you're onto something in your work is that if in the mode you've made, you have strong opinions. Mm-hmm. You know, the nightmare for a writer is when you start something and you get into it and you're like, I don't know. I don't know. I'm just lost here. Whereas if you have a story, you know, for example, if I'm trying to be funny, I always know how to be funny. It's not a decision. It's not a chore. It's just a series of natural reactions. So part of it is to try to guide the young writer into a mode or a form or a voice that she feels really happy about, or, you know, at least energetic about. Because in the book, one of the things I say is that a work of art becomes unique to that artist by way of the thousands or tens of thousands of micro choices that the artist makes along the way. In the writer's case, it's in revision. So the more opinionated you are, the more joyfully opinionated you are, the more decisive those decisions are, the more kind of emphatic. And I think that's what we ultimately love in a book, is we feel another human being there fully realized on the other side.
George Saunders is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a masterclass on writing, reading, and life. We should mention that the course includes many more stories. You whittled this down quite a bit, almost a third of the full list in the course. What was that process like and landing on these four?
Yeah, it would have been a 6,000-page book, which I thought might, you know. So basically, the short list or the sort of shorter list was to say, what are the stories that when I teach them, the classroom always lights up? So, and, you know, after teaching it so many times, you can kind of say, ooh, Tolstoy's coming up. That'll be a good day, you know. So there was about 15 of those, and then that's still too many. So then it became a matter of just simply asking which stories teach the best, which one of them will lead me the most quickly to these major points I want to make. So I actually left out some of my favorite stories. There are some of them, like Lady with Pet Dog by Chekhov or Death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy. They're so good that whatever you say is a little inadequate. You sort of end up being a little bit hyperbolic instead of specific. But if you take the sort of next tier down of stories that are really, really wonderful, but maybe aren't, you know, total masterpieces, there's often more to say about those. Because, you know, one thing that helps a young writer is to see little moments where the writer faltered, you know, or made a choice that maybe wasn't that great. Or, I could imagine another book, you know, like A Swim in a Filthy Pond in the Rain, where you were only looking at bad stories or, you know, maybe the Chekhov stories that weren't that successful. So really, it was kind of a matter of then arranging the stories in order so that the over essay that I was writing would be graceful and that I wouldn't be repeating myself or contradicting myself. It's kind of a Rubik's Cube that I worked with for 2 years.
You, in writing about Chekhov, you talk about specifics, you talk about specificity, and I'm interested in why that, of what strikes you about that and why it's important for writers.
If you imagine somebody telling you a story about something that happened to them during the day, there's something about specific facts that draws us in and makes us believe the story. And especially when the story is made up, this is a really critical thing. You know, so if I say, once upon a time, some people were in this one place, you know, I haven't done you any favors. There's nothing happening between us. But if I say, four Presbyterians were in a bomb shelter, suddenly we're somewhere. So I think that, and then also it's interesting, the specificity, as it just did, leads to better sentences. If you have a sentence that's okay and you say, well, let me be as specific as I can, that sentence somehow becomes more energetic, more muscular, more efficient. So it's kind of a cycle, and I don't really understand the ultimate cause for it, but I think probably it's just that, you know, our storytelling function in our brain was, I suppose, a survival thing to start with. You know, if I want to tell you that there's a tiger coming up behind you, I need to be specific. Mm. You know, you can't just say, hey, things are looking bad for you. You know, it's better to say, tiger, run. So I think that we develop a taste for specific language, and our whole system of judging whether a sentence is good has to do with whether it's specific. And anyway, on a sort of, you know, short-term basis, if a writer moves an opening paragraph towards specificity, it will inevitably produce plot, because those four Presbyterians in the bomb shelter, you know, they're Presbyterians. Why are they Presbyterians? How did the Presbyterians get there? Why are they in a bomb shelter? What's going on outside? So a sentence that's increasingly specific also kind of gives off more questions. And that's kind of the currency that the story runs on, is that the reader is, his mind or her mind is filling up with questions as she reads, which is part of the reason that she keeps going.
That idea of reading because you want the answers to those questions, I was thinking as I was exploring this with you in the book, is reading, because I remember this feeling of reading Lincoln in the Bardo, because you are wonderfully, beautifully, specifically vague often, in the sense that there's great specificity, and yet you don't know where you are quite. There is the mysterious element to it, which is what catches you of wanting to go further, to ask those questions.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully put. There, you know, there's a way that you can be specific and still, I mean, if you and I suddenly opened our eyes, and there was, you know, in front of us was a Gazelle and what looked like a shopping mall and a Toyota. You know, we could see those things clearly, but we wouldn't know where we were. And I think that's, and the first question we would ask is, I would say, Joe, where are we? Suddenly we're reading, you know? And so part of my process has been to, you know, you're always trying to find that line where I'm giving you enough of a hint that you'll follow me, but not so much of a hint that you'll be bored in following me. And that's just iterative. You know, you do it over and over again. In Lincoln and the Bardo, I had so many places where in rereading it, I would go, oh, that's too much. You know, for example, I never use the word ghost for exactly that reason. Right. So that is, you know, one of the things I try to touch on in the book is that as much as we like to talk about art and articulate it and so on, the difference between somebody who's a good artist and not so good is these small decisions that I think you only make on the fly. And in my case, I make them by repeating, by going through it so many times and just micro-tuning it. It's something like making soup to taste, I think, you know. And at the end of the day, that's the skill, is that you can make the soup to taste. And when someone says, how do you make soup? And you say, oh, to taste. It makes for a short craft talk, but that's actually the, you know, the million-dollar truth is that the thing that distinguishes a writer from non is the quality of those thousands of small intuitive decisions.
In writing about Chekhov and Turgenev, Tolstoy, Gogol, what was it about their characteristics that you found interesting? Because while, yes, they are all Russian story writers, they are very different too.
Yes, I think, I mean, you know, I don't know. I know that I just loved them since I was young, and I think the stories are simple. And they tend to ask the big questions that I'm interested in. I don't really want to read fiction I just read it for sort of moral ethical clarity. It's part of my philosophical or spiritual life. But also these stories, for whatever reason, maybe it's because I love them, they just teach really well. They're kind of the Platonic version of stories. They're very simple. And I think that's because in their time, they seem to kind of tacitly agree that that's what stories were for. Stories were to, I wouldn't say to instruct our journey through life, but to deepen it. You know, that's, we're in this world, we don't really understand what's going on. Every so often, as it's doing right now in the pandemic, it speeds up and the cruelty of the world becomes more evident. And there's sweet little us, you know, like what we were planning on going to a show, you know, and suddenly the world falls apart. So I think all of us, you know, have those moments when we go, what the heck is going on here? You know, what am I supposed to do? And in times like these, that question becomes just dominant. But I think the Russians were people who understood in that period that that's really what art is best at. You know, again, not solving problems. As Chekhov says, it's not to solve problems, it's to formulate them correctly. So I always feel like reading these stories, it sends me back into the world feeling that I have more responsibility. And then also I have more freedom and kind of, it's just, everything looks more interesting after I read about one of these stories.
That's interesting. What do you feel your responsibility is as a writer?
You know, I was talking to Tobias Wolff the other day on an event, and he brought up our mutual friend, Michael Hare, who's from up in this beautiful part of the world that we're in. And he said that one time there was a discussion about political intent in writing. And Michael said something like, and I'll paraphrase him badly here, but he said basically, should is the enemy of the artist. For me, it's, I can certainly talk a blue streak about what art does and so on, and I like to do it. But in the most truthful mode, I think the artist is, as Chekhov said, it's supposed to be free, you know, free of everything, free of must, free of should, free of intention, free of agenda, free of politics, at least at the start. And then as you work, the story will tell you its needs, and your job is to be there for that. And then, and the beautiful thing is at the end of it, you will have said something political and something, you know, you will have discharged some kind of duty, but somehow it's the one part of my life anyway, where I feel completely on a good day, unencumbered by my kind of pesky habitual mind. And I'm able to tap into something a little deeper. And it does feel very much like freedom, like you can choose, you know, you can blunder off in the direction of delighting yourself. And I think that's the little doorway we have to enter through. And then all the rest will come on its own.
How much is freedom and joy hampered by things like what's happening in the outside world, a pandemic, a coup, a dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, you know, I sit down and I think, oh God, how can I write a story about this little, you know, thing when all this big stuff is going on? I think you have to be honest about, as an artist, honest about the form you're working in and the energy available in the piece you're working on. So for example, if I'm, you know, if I have a, as I've tried to do several times over the last few years, trying to write an overtly political piece, at some point it will just disappoint me. You know, my agenda is too clear. I'm preaching to the choir, and the story is not doing that essential complicating work that these great ones do. So then I just let it go. And then conversely, you come back and you start writing about, you know, a talking pencil sharpener on your desk just for fun. One, that story will have energy because you're having fun with it. And often you'll, you know, if, again, if you force it to do the work of a story, it will go deep. And it might not be directly political, but it'll be considerable, you know. So I think for me, it's, well, I guess I'll go back to the, you know, I've been making these talks, you know, in support of this book. And I always talk about this idea that, you know, you shouldn't think about a story being overtly political. And then the other day I came in and I started the most overtly political story I've ever written, you know. So the beauty of it is, you know, the part of you that knows is kind of sidelined, and there's a deeper part that wants to be at the writing table. But I, you know, and I also think writing this book made me realize too that the comforts of fiction, you know, if we want to talk about the coup attempt, for example, we could have a story directly about a parallel coup attempt, and that would be okay. But these stories, these Russian stories, do something that is deeper, and I think you could make the case that it's political. But what they do is they remind us of how capacious the human mind is. So Chekhov goes into his subject and he tells you one opinion and another, and they all contradict and they all seem correct. And I think in that process, you're reminded that our everyday abilities aren't our only ones. There are deeper ways of understanding that we have access to. And Chekhov just proved it, because he confused you in this kind of sacred way at the end of the story. And in a sense, what I think he's doing, he's saying, see, you're more than you think you are. You're more than the guy who gets up in the morning and starts grousing about politics. So in that deeper way, they're almost, this might be overstating it, but I think you could see them as being somewhat sacramental. And that if you have a reaction like that to a story, it just reminds you that you're capable of that. In the same way that, you know, maybe your 20 minutes at the end of a Catholic Mass remind you that you're not just you, you know. So you go into the world with a slightly improved opinion of yourself, but also maybe an improved opinion of the world.
So let's end here, which is what we often hear is to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader. In your opinion, what is a great reader? What makes a great reader?
I think I want to say awareness. So in other words, as you're reading, there's part of your mind that's just having the experience. And then there's another part of your mind that's kind of split out and watching the other part of the mind have the experience. That seems to me, if both of those parts are fully on, that's the reader I'd like to have. Because that means, as a writer, I can play with that second part of the mind. Like, for example, I can write a purposely slow section, and that second part of the mind is going, we're losing energy here. This is a little boring. And then if I can make that slow section pay off somehow, then the second part of the mind goes, aha, he knew it all along. Then you've got a real healthy back and forth going on in this conversation between reader and writer. So I think, you know, to be able to read with an open mind so that you don't have a lot of preconceptions. And, you know, the people I meet on the road, it's really something. You know, the last two books, I got to do a lot of events and always sign books at the end. So there's like an hour, sometimes even more, of talking to people. And it was so encouraging to me to learn how many people have reading at the center of their lives and how good it is for them and how hard they'll fight for that time and how it expands their life in general. So I think that kind of person who understands that reading is almost like physical exercise or like prayer or something. That's the kind of reader I hope I can get to.
Was it like that for you as a kid? I know it was for me. I mean, my mother was a librarian, but it was sacred to read.
Yes. You know, it was one of those things where I felt it as enjoyable and fun, and also the people around me seemed to admire me when I was reading. You know, they let it be known that you don't have to clean your room if you're reading. You know, I was talking to Ann Patchett the other day, and she brought up something really interesting, that when we were students, which I think was about the same time in maybe the 80s, that readings, literary readings, would often be over an hour long. She talked about Toby Wolfe reading two of his stories, and I heard him read the entire Gooseberries trilogy that I referred to in the book, which would have been, I think, at least an hour and a half, you know? And she was just noting how people's attention spans and their patience for that kind of reading has gone down, which I thought was interesting because it was true. An hour-long reading used to not be excessive. But I think it's such a holy thing to do, you know? And I think not for, you know, gauzy, mystical, sentimental reasons, but I think I'd be willing to guess that if you could do some kind of brain scan, you'd find out that when a reader is reading a fictional text, the mind is maybe even more fully engaged than when you're walking through the forest. You know, there's more going on there. And it's, I think, as a gateway to empathy, I don't think there's anything else like it. And not in any other art form, not in real life. It's some kind of synthetic way of getting inside somebody else's head, and that's so good for us, you know. And I think actually right now we're suffering from it because so much of our reading is not that anymore. It's superficial, and it's laced with agenda, and it's meant by the corporations that are enabling it to agitate us. And that, I think we're starting to see the effects of that
because we lose the empathy.
Yeah, I think you probably find that it's a totally different kind of reading when you're scanning your phone in order to heap abuse upon the people you believe are your enemies. There's a different chemical thing going on there. And to read a Chekhov story, you often start off maybe disliking the main character or feeling distance from her. And by the end of the story, you are her. And that exercise in itself is so beautiful.
That's beautifully put. The name of the new book is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, in which four Russians give a masterclass on writing, reading, and life. The book is published by Random House. George Saunders, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you so much for your time.
Joe, I love being with you. Your mind is so wonderful about reading and writing, and it always inspires me. Thank you.
Again, the name of the book is A Swim in a Pond in the Rain. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. Thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.